Face the Nation, coming up next.
You know, at PodcastOne.com, we love hearing from you, so keep on sending those tweets and comments, because we read every one of them. Your opinion is important. That's why we don't want you to miss the chance to take our listener survey at PodcastOne.com. You see, your responses will help us make this show the very best it can be. It's not a lot of effort, because it'll only take you about 3 minutes, and you'll get the instant gratification that comes with knowing that you helped us get better. So do it now. Take the survey at PodcastOne.com. That's PodcastOne.com. And don't forget, keep those tweets and comments coming.
From CBS News in Washington, Face the Nation with Bob Schieffer.
Today on Face the Nation, 2014 marks the 60th year of this broadcast, and we started with one of Washington's most powerful but rarely interviewed officials, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid.
The House will be in order.
2013 was not exactly a banner year from Washington. Will this year be any better?
No organizational or legislative business will be conducted on this day.
So it's official, nothing to report so far. But what are the prospects for immigration reform, cutting the deficit, extending unemployment benefits? What will happen to Obamacare? And what about the National Security Agency? We'll ask the Senate's top Democrat, Harry Reid, who'll control much of the agenda on Capitol Hill. Then we'll talk to key House Republicans, New York's Peter King and Arizona's Matt Salmon. We'll have analysis from Peggy Noonan of the Wall Street Journal, David Ignatius of the Washington Post, David Sanger of the New York Times, and CBS News political director John Dickerson. And in our flashback, how a CBS News crew went to Havana to interview Fidel Castro for Face the Nation and got scooped by Ed Sullivan. 60 years of news, because this is Face the Nation. And good morning again. And before we get to Senator Reid, a quick update on this bitter cold that has two-thirds of the country in its grip, from the Midwest to the Northeast and a good part of the South. This cold is expected to set record lows in many parts of the country. Some of the coldest weather so far is in the St. Paul, Minneapolis area. And WCCO-TV reporter Jamie Yukas has the latest from there. Jamie.
Bob, it is currently 9 degrees below zero, and it's only expected to get worse. For the first time in 20 years, schools are closed statewide on Monday, with lows expected at minus 25, with wind chills expected to be around minus 70 degrees. Exposed skin can become frostbitten in just minutes. Ski hills and ice rinks have closed until Tuesday at the earliest. Today's Green Bay Packers playoff game could be among one of the coldest NFL games ever played. The temperature at Lambeau Field is expected to be 2 degrees below zero, with wind chills at minus 30 when the Packers and San Francisco 49ers kick off. The Arctic air will keep its trek east as well. By Monday, Chicago will likely hit 15 below. New York and New England will deal with frigid temperatures as residents there continue to dig out from that massive snowstorm. Many heading south to escape the cold could also be out of luck. Atlanta is forecasted to stay in the 20s, and those chilly temps could continue into Florida. Highs in the Minneapolis area may reach above zero by Wednesday, but many meteorologists predict that now that we've seen these cold temperatures, it'll just continue through the rest of the winter season. Bob?
All right. Well, thanks, Jamie. Now get inside quick. Thank you.
Sounds good.
Well, Washington is seeing some of the lowest temperatures in about 20 years. It is not 9 below as it is out there in Minneapolis, but we want to thank Senator Harry Reid for braving the cold to come inside and join us. Senator Reid, thank you. We
really
don't see
pleasure.
You very often. We hope we'll see you often, though, during this new year. Let's start out by talking about unemployment benefits. It ran out for 1.3 million Americans in December. You have said, the president has said, this is going to be one of the priority items here. It's also going to cost $26 billion for the year. Republicans are already saying no way unless you agree to somehow offset that with spending cuts. Are you willing to negotiate
this
on that?
This is typical for Republican members of Congress. Not Republicans, but Republican members of Congress. The vast majority of American people believe that unemployment benefits should be extended. Never with unemployment like this have we ever even considered not extending them. And John McCain, chief economic advisor during his presidential campaign, Mark Zandi, said for every dollar we spend on unemployment benefits, the government and the country gets back 50 cents extra. It's so important to do this. The gross domestic product would be increased by $23 billion. It's the right thing to do. We have long-term unemployment, and that's why the American people support this. Democrats, independents, and Republicans.
Well, Senator, you praised the budget deal back in December for reducing the deficit. You said that's something that had to be done. But aren't you just undoing that now with this?
Bob, the place we always look to find out what's happening with the deficit is Bowles Simpson. They set a goal of $4 trillion. We've already approached $9 trillion. And if we did comprehensive immigration reform, it would be taken care of. We'd be at $4 trillion. So it seems to me that we should start focusing, as we have, on reducing the debt. We've done that. But let's start focusing on helping the middle class. We have a situation in America today that is really not good. The last 30 years, the top 1% of Americans and their income and wealth has increased 300%. The middle class during that same 30 years has lost almost 10%. We've got to turn this around. I want the economy to be good. I want people to be rich, and I have nothing against rich people. But the rich are getting richer. The poor are getting poorer. The middle class is being squeezed out of existence.
Well, let me just ask you about a straight-out political question here. If the Republicans try to filibuster this, and so far I think there's only one Republican senator that has said he's ready to go along with you on this, do you have the votes to block a filibuster on this?
It seems to me that here we have a bipartisan bill. We have one of the liberal members of the Senate, Jack Reed of Rhode Island, and one of the conservative members of the Senate, Dean Heller from Nevada. They say we should extend these unemployment benefits, and they're right.
But hey, that's the only Republican. Am I not?
Well, but remember, there's 55 of us, and there's 45 of them. It would seem to me that five Republicans in the Senate should agree with the Republicans around the country. Republicans around America want us to do something to extend these benefits. Why? Because it's good for the economy. It's good for the country. Every one of these people that's long-term unemployed, they get one of these checks. They spend the money. They don't put it in the bank. It helps small business. That's why small business favor this. The same reason they favor doing something about minimum wage. They know it's good for the economy. And so Republicans in Congress have to get away from being Republicans in Congress. Background checks. 90% of Americans want that. Republicans in Congress oppose it. Extending unemployment benefits. 75% of Americans want that done. Republicans in Congress oppose it. Extending minimum wage. Same thing. They're out of touch with what's going on in America today.
Let me just ask you this, Senator. I think most people would say that the last meeting of Congress was probably the least productive, maybe in history. It's certainly the least productive that I can remember. What you seem to be saying to me is, listen, we're in for the absolute same thing. Nothing much is going to change here.
Bob, unless the Republicans in Congress decide they should do something for the American people, I'm sorry to say that's true. Rating of Congress is down. If somebody called me in a poll, I would vote with them. This is awful what's been going on. And that's the reason, Bob, that we had to change the rules. They were even opposing people who were part of Obama's team. Never in the history of the country. To show you how out of line this has gotten, one of my predecessors, Lyndon Johnson, was leader for 6 years. He had overcome one or two filibusters. Me, 430 filibusters. Things have gotten way out of whack, and that's why we change the rules, and now we say majority, that's not such a bad word, is it? Majority is going to determine who can be on President Obama's team. The founding fathers, you know, this filibuster that they so love is not part of the Constitution. It's not a privilege, it's a right.
Let me ask you this.
I'm sorry, it's a privilege, not a right. And Bob, I want to just say this. The founding fathers, they decided what should be supermajority, you know, impeachments and stuff like that. One of them wasn't approving nominations.
Well, let me just ask you this. I mean, listening to you this morning, if Republicans continue to throw up the kind of opposition you've been receiving, you say you've been receiving, do you have plans to extend this ban on filibusters? Right now, you've worked out this rule, which they vehemently oppose, it's very difficult for them to filibuster nominations. Would you be willing to just go to a Senate where you just majority rules and that's it?
Well, Bob, I think it's something that we have to understand.
So you're thinking about that?
That's this. We cannot have a country that's paralyzed because of a group of people. The group of people, who are they? Tea Party-driven Republicans in Congress. Not Republicans. I'm not here to badmouth Republicans around the country. I get a lot of support from Republicans in Nevada, and always have had. But they're mainstream Republicans. They're not driven by this craziness that we have in America today. So the answer is this. We should pass raising the minimum wage. We should extend unemployment benefits. We should get rid of these tax loopholes and create jobs so the middle class can start growing, not shrinking.
But would you do away with filibusters entirely?
Well, we're not there yet. I think that
I mean, are you even thinking about that?
No, I'm not thinking about it today. But I think
you're saying you're holding that out. Is that as a possibility?
I think everyone should understand that the country cannot continue on the road that it's on. It cannot have. You cannot have, when you have vacancies in the judiciary, as we've had, D.C. Circuit. Some say it's more important than the Supreme Court, but it's at least the second most important. They said, we're not going to fill these spots because we don't want to. You can't. That's not the way we legislate.
Do you think that the minimum wage will pass? Can you get the votes to pass an increase in the minimum wage?
I think that there are five Republicans, Dean Heller plus four Republicans. Remember, Dean Heller is not some maverick that is out spewing socialism. Here's a guy who's really a conservative person, and he wants to extend unemployment benefits. I admire him for doing that. And can we get four Republicans agree with the American people that we should do that? I would certainly hope so.
So you're saying that that's still very much in doubt because you can't get four Republicans.
Well, I'm saying hopefully.
Hopefully
we can get four more Republicans. Gee whiz, I mean, this is something we've never stopped unemployment.
Let me just ask you quickly, getting back to the budget agreement we talked about that you all made in December, you have just 2 weeks to get those funds appropriated and allocated to get the whole package through the Congress again. Do you think that that's going to happen?
Bob, the answer is yes, but let me just say this as a cautionary note.
Because if you don't, don't raise the debt ceiling.
Yes, I understand. A cautionary note. What was done by Congressman Ryan and Senator Murray was historic. It's wonderful that these two people on opposite sides of the political spectrum got together and did good work. I will always admire them for that. And we should get the appropriation now. We got Mikulski. She's doing a great job and she's working with the counterpart in the House. But, Bob, I'm afraid. Why am I afraid? It was just a matter of a couple months ago that two-thirds of the Republicans in the House of Representatives voted to keep the government closed and default on the debt. So I hope we can get this done, but I am really concerned about what's going on with Republicans in Congress. Repeat to your viewers. Two-thirds of the people in the House of Representatives, the Republicans, voted to close the government, keep it closed more than 16 days, and default on our debt. I want this to pass. I hope it does. It should. That we have an omnibus appropriation bill, but I don't know.
What do you think about the future of Obamacare? Republicans were willing to shut down the government in an effort to kill it. They didn't do it. Then it had this disastrous rollout when this is an election year for a bunch of your Democrats in the mm-hmm. Senate, 21 of them up,
21 of us, 14 of them.
Yeah.
Bob,
Will Democrats run as proud sponsors of Obamacare, or will they run away from it?
It's interesting. I can't come here and say the rollout was great. It was awful. But look, let's look where we are today. The website's been fixed. Perfect? No. But right now, as we speak, there are 9 million Americans, 9 million Americans who have health care that didn't have it before. We have 3 million Medicare. We have 3 million on their policies because they're at reach age. They haven't reached age 26. They can stay on their parents' policy. And we have more than 2 million. They're coming. I talked to the president, chief of staff, a day or two ago, Dennis McDonough. They're coming on at the rate of 30,000 a day. I think we're going to have some staggering numbers, even more than this, come April 1st. We're at 9 million already. It's the law. Is that important? Of course. Women are no longer considered a pre-existing disability. Seniors, the donut hole's being filled. They can have their checks. They can do pap smears, all this stuff that women couldn't do before. Insurance companies can't cancel you for no reason. We have...
It's going to work?
It's already working. All right. And Republicans should get a life and start talking about doing something constructively.
Right.
All they talk about is how bad Obamacare is. They don't talk about doing anything to improve it.
Well, we've got a couple of them in the wings here, and we'll see what they say about it. Mr. Leader, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate having you. And now, how it looks from the other side of the street. We do have, indeed, two Republicans. Congressman Peter King is in New York, and Congressman Matt Salmon joins us from his district in Phoenix. So let me just go to you. I'll go to you first, Congressman King. What's your reaction to what you heard from Senator Reid here this morning?
Actually, Bob, I was very disappointed because I thought the days of government shutdowns were behind us. And just the whole implication there with Senator Reid is when you basically said to him, are you going to pass the omnibus appropriation bill? And he sort of hesitated, somehow sending out a threat of maybe shutting down the government or slowing down the process. That's the wrong attitude to have at the beginning of the year. We can have disagreements, but I think we have to find ways to compromise. I mean, on all the issues he was talking about, I think there's a possibility for compromise. But if he's going to be talking from day one or implying that there could be shutdowns, to me, that's the wrong way to start. It's the wrong message to send. And if something does happen, I think it can be traced right back to the show this morning. Based on what Senator Reid said.
Oh, well, Congressman Salmon, what's your reaction?
Well, I think it's interesting that Senator Reid spent his entire time just blaming Republicans for everything, every calamity in the world, and not really offering any solutions. I think that's why the American people think that the Congress is so dysfunctional, because it's just partisan politics. Honestly, I think we deserve better. And if Senator Reid is that interested in improving the economy and in helping us get jobs again, maybe he could just take up at least one of the 39 bills, jobs-related bills, that we've sent from the Republican House to the Senate, which languishes in his drawer. The fact is, these giveaway programs, government programs, don't create one job, not one job. If we want to energize the job market, we need to get rid of backbreaking, job-breaking regulations and our tax policy that is hurting our economy.
Well, let me just ask you, Mr. Salmon, what about this extending the unemployment benefits? He does make the point, and economists back this up, that some of this unemployment insurance that is paid out does go back into the economy. It's not all a giveaway. I mean, it's a big cost, a big ticket item, $26 billion for a year. But some of it does get back into the economy. Will you support that in some fashion?
If the senator comes up with any kind of a reasonable idea to offset the $26 billion, I think that he might find some people that are willing to talk to him. But I think that we need to focus our attention more on not what problem itself, but focus on the root cause, and that is unemployment. Let's get people back to work. Let's approve the Keystone Pipeline. Let's deal with one of the 39 jobs bills that we've sent him to try to get our economy going again and people working in the private sector.
All right, well,
the answer isn't government. The answer is the private sector. Let's get it going again.
Congressman King, do you see any way, any kind of a compromise that could be struck to continue at least some part of this unemployment insurance for these people?
Yeah, I agree with what Matt said about cutting back on the regulations and trying to unleash the economy in the private sector. I would, however, want to support an extension of unemployment benefits, at least to some extent, for a brief period of time. And only speaking for myself, I'm not saying it has to be offset dollar for dollar, but there has to be some compromise coming from the Democrats. I don't want to have this permanent state of unemployment insurance where we end up like Europe. On the other hand, there are people who are looking for work, who need some help. So I would like to find a way to get a compromise to extend unemployment insurance, at least for a brief period of time. But at the same time, the Democrats should make compromises as far as some burdensome regulations to attempt to unleash the economy, because the ultimate answer is not unemployment insurance. The ultimate answer is more jobs. But for a temporary period of time, I could see an extension of unemployment benefits, but again, with restrictions on it, so we don't have a permanent class of people on unemployment insurance, and it doesn't become an impediment to jobs, and it doesn't create a state of dependency.
Let me ask both of you, do you think there is any chance that raising the minimum wage will happen this year, Mr. Salmon?
Well, first of all, I think that the raising of the minimum wage actually hurts the very people we're trying to help. If the Obama administration wants to raise the minimum wage to $10 an hour, and I don't believe, again, that's the government is the answer. I believe that the answer is to
Can I just stop you and just ask you an obvious question? Why does it hurt someone to pay them more money? Because that's what you just said.
Well, I'll tell you how it hurts them. The people that are mostly on minimum wage are the folks that are 18 to 28. And those folks right now have the highest unemployment rate in the country, by far, not even close. And history has shown us that when the minimum wage rises, those companies that are paying minimum wage jobs end up laying people off, and they end up hiring less people. And what I mean by them actually being the people that are hurt.
Gotcha. Mr. King, what do you think about it? Do you think we ought to raise the minimum wage?
I've supported it in the past, but for the last several years I have not, because when the economy is down the way it is, I think it's an extra burden that you're imposing on employers as they try to come out of the recession. I would, again, consider an increase in it, but it has to be coinciding with a cutting back on some of the burdens that are on employers. Because otherwise, as Matt was saying, we could increase minimum wage, but with more people being laid off. To me, we have to, again, if we can get to compromise, we can get things on the table where the Democrats are willing to give up some of these restrictions and burdens that are on businesses, then I'd be willing to consider somewhat of an increase in the minimum wage. But again, the ultimate answer is to allow the private sector to expand, and we're not going to do that so long as we keep adding regulation on top of regulation, and people like Senator Reid refuse to talk about lifting any of those regulations.
Let me ask you, Mr. Go ahead.
Yeah. I was just going to say that I have conversations with a lot of the Democrats on the floor, a lot of them very, very dear friends of mine, and they're as frustrated as I am with leaders like Harry Reid that just want to continue to push a partisan agenda. And they, like us, believe that there are answers, that we can cross the aisle and work together. But I think that the leadership has to come from the top. When I was in Congress before, we served with Bill Clinton as president. In fact, Peter King and I both served together during the 90s, and we were able to do all kinds of things. Trade policies that grew our economy, reducing the deficit. In fact, we balanced the budget for the first time in 40 years in 98.
Okay.
This president is a polarizing figure that does nothing but address a my way or the highway attitude.
Right.
And until we have a president that's willing to reach across the aisle, it's going to be very, very difficult.
All right. We have to stop it there. The clock just ran out. We'll be back in 1 minute with a look at the history of Face the Nation. It seems like only yesterday. People always say that, but actually it doesn't seem that way. It seems like about 60 years ago, because it was November 7th, 1954, that CBS launched Face the Nation. Contrary to the belief of some, I have not been at Face the Nation the entire time. I've only been at CBS 45 years, the last 23 at Face the Nation. Face, as we call it, was the brainchild of the late Frank Stanton, who ran the network in the early days. When I asked him some years ago why he started it, he said simply, because NBC had Meet the Press, and I thought we needed a program like that. Today, the two broadcasts are the oldest programs on television. The first guest was Joe McCarthy. Producers were apprehensive. He had shown up at another network packing a pistol, but he came to CBS unarmed. Over the years, everyone from Nikita Khrushchev and a parade of foreign potentates
against our rights
to the cream of the crop of American politics
presidents, candidates, diplomats, civil rights leaders, war leaders, and revolutionaries.
I am their leader.
Authors and opinion makers all came to face the nation.
So tell these unions their business.
AFL-CIO Chief George Meany was one of the few who showed up late. When moderator George Herman chided him by saying, "Don't you know I'm a good union man?" Meany responded, "Yours is not much of a union." In the early days, Face the Nation included a live report beamed to New York all the way from New Jersey. Now we can speak to newsmakers at any point on the globe. For all the technology, the remarkable thing about Face the Nation is how little it has changed. We still do exactly what they did in the beginning. We sit down the key newsmakers of the week, turn on the lights, and ask them about the news of the day. You, our viewers, have seemed to appreciate that over the years, so in case you're wondering, we'll try to get better. But basically, we'll celebrate this 60th year by doing just what we've been doing. We won't change much. Back in a minute. Well, some of our stations are leaving us now, but for most of you, we'll be right back, so stay with us. Well, welcome back to Face the Nation on this cold Sunday, and joining us now for us from analysis, and boy, do we have a lot to talk about, Peggy Noonan, columnist for the Wall Street Journal, Washington Post columnist David Ignatius, David Sanger, the national security correspondent for the New York Times, and our own CBS News political director, John Dickerson. John, Harry Reid came out both barrels blazing this morning. If anybody was talking about a new attitude in Congress, I didn't really see that this morning.
That's right. He had one target. That was the Republicans in Congress. He must have said it five different times. He had his talking points ready. 2014 is not going to be a happy year. And why? Let's look at the Senate. Let's just look at the elections in the Senate. Okay. The Republicans need to take six seats to take Harry Reid's job away from him. In seven of the seats that where Democrats are in danger, they are in states where Mitt Romney won the election. We've seen over the last 20 years a correlation between if voters in a state vote for a Republican president, they're likely to vote for a Republican senator. And so Democrats have a tough year with the elections. And so Harry Reid begins a tough election year, starting with tough words about Republicans.
Does the rollout of Obamacare make it tougher for these Democrats? I asked Harry Reid the question, and he didn't really answer it. I said, are they going to be run as proud sponsors of Obamacare, or are they going to run away from it?
It does for a few reasons. One, it's just a distraction. Every minute a Democrat is talking about Obamacare, it's not a minute they can be talking about unemployment insurance extensions, minimum wage, or whatever else it is that they want to be talking about. So that's just at a basic level, Democrats are on their heels a little bit. Also, it riles up Republican voters. In midterm elections, the people who vote tend to be your base voters, and the people who tend to vote. There has only been one election since 1958 in which the president's party gained seats. Why is that? Because the party that's out of power in the White House is more riled up. Well, the Affordable Care Act riles up those Republicans. And in those tough races, which are all in red states, those are riled up Republicans with an issue that they don't like, the Affordable Care Act. And every Republican I talk to in the House and the Senate says, this is what we're going to be talking about this year, not only on the stump, but in oversight hearings in the House and in every opportunity they can find.
Let me go to Peggy. Republicans, a lot of people thought Republicans had really hurt themselves when they led the drive to shut down the government in 2013. The publicity about the rollout of Obamacare kind of blunted that to some extent. But do you think we'll now see a battle over the debt ceiling to let the government default on the bills that for things they've already, money they've already spent? Because as you heard Harry Reid this morning, he doesn't seem in a mood to put anything, make any kind of compromises on that or do anything to get Republican votes to
There's a little jujitsu going on there. He thinks a government shutdown would be really terrible. I think he would love it. It would not be good. It would not be good for the Republicans, and I think they would try hard actually to see that that didn't happen. But I thought the big thing about the Reid interview is that it was not full of reaching out and comity and we can do this together with the Republicans. It was those bad Republicans and that terrible, historically bad Tea Party. So I consider that quite suggestive of maybe a bit of a freeze in 2014.
You're nodding your head, David.
I feel the same way that Peggy does. Last year ended with scenes of comedy and bipartisanship. You had Paul Ryan and Patty Murray put together a budget deal that blunted the effects of sequestration. You had John Boehner declare his independence from the Tea Party in an amazing press conference, said they've lost all credibility. And, you know, you wouldn't have been crazy to think that this year would begin with someone like Harry Reid offering a more gentle tone and sort of reaching out to Boehner, saying Boehner's come some distance. And what was surprising this morning was that rather than try to see if legislating, which appears to be popular with the public, might be a strategy, I heard Harry Reid saying, no, it's going to be more of the same polarized by partisan politics, and I'm surprised.
Well, David, I mean, you cover foreign policy, you cover national security and things like that. Just step back from this interview this morning, and how did you take it?
Well, I thought there were two interesting things across the three interviews you had. The first was you didn't hear a broad vision from any of the three who you interviewed for an American resurgence out of this. And for President Obama, I think that's troublesome because Obamacare has really led to the question, can these guys execute the way that President Obama had really promised when he came to office first in 2009? And I think that was the most harmful part of Obamacare. But the second thing that President Obama and I think Harry Reid and the other Democrats who are leading the party tried to grab in 2009 was a vision of where the country was going. And you heard a very down in the weeds, you know, what kind of advance can we make as far as February and getting past the next budget hurdle. And I'm not sure right now, heading into elections, that's really their best strategy, because you see a hunger for the question of American resurgence and then the question of whether or not the U.S. is leaving a power vacuum around the world in many of the places we're seeing erupt.
In a domestic context, I think the larger argument Democrats want to try and make is that we are the party that cares about you. That's what minimum wage is about. That's what extending unemployment benefits is about. And we care about you, and we're working hard for these things, and those mean Republicans don't. In the middle of the Affordable Care Act's launchpad disaster, when it launched so poorly, when the website wasn't working, talking to Democrats, both in the House and the Senate, they said, we need a new fight. We need a budget fight, because budgets are about priorities. And even if it's a little issue like a minimum wage, that's a priority. It's a question of, are you for the little guy or are you for the companies? And that's a fight where Democrats are comfortable. It's part of their longtime hymnal that they can all sing together, as opposed to Affordable Care Act, where they're kind of fighting a little bit with each other. And so their larger national narrative for domestic politics, which they think is going to rule in these elections, is going to be about who cares about you. And they'll find every little tiny thing to make that argument, and that's what the fight about the minimum wage and unemployment benefits, that's what that'll be
about.
Well,
the president is talking about income inequality. I mean, we get word from Hawaii that that's what he's coming back to Washington to talk about. What does that mean to you, Peggy?
What it means to me is that he does not want to talk about Obamacare. It is widely assumed that in 2014, the bad news of Obamacare, the dislocations, the lost coverage, the price hikes, the premium hikes, et cetera, that all of this will continue. It's not the website. The website's the old story. It is the program. It will unveil over the next 2 years, and it's going to be problematic. The president does not want to talk about it. The Democrats do not want to talk about it. Therefore, income equality, minimum wage, et cetera, they need to change the subject.
David, how did this go so wrong? I mean, when you stop and think about it, I mean, the fact that people ought to have health insurance, and if poor people can't afford it, they ought to be able to get some relief on that. I mean, that would seem to be kind of a universal truth to me. And yet, this thing is the most tangled up. I've never seen anything quite like the way this thing is unfolding.
Historians will write memorable books about how this got so messed up, how the president left the details to people who couldn't execute them. is the biggest mystery of all. There was a consensus back in 2008 that something needed to be done about the delivery of healthcare services. It cost too much. What we monkeyed with instead is how healthcare is financed, which I think was a mistake. And I think you look back on the debate in 2009, the president really didn't have the votes. He had to jam it through with some sort of legislative maneuvers because the Congress wasn't quite ready and the country wasn't quite ready. So we're living with the after effects of that now. Thinking about this year ahead, the election of a new mayor in New York, very liberal, replacing the defining figure of centrism and moderation, Mayor Bloomberg, I wonder whether this is going to be a year in which these liberal themes, even Obamacare, minimum wage, income inequality, will move to the front for Democrats and for the country.
Well, the president's got an opportunity in that regard because, he ended the year with the stock market at an incredible high and with this termination of some of the unemployment benefits. And that's quite a division that the president can sort of run through when he gets to the State of the Union. Now, whether or not he manages to do that without further polarizing an already polarized system, that's the hard question.
That's right, because income inequality is a real big issue. It's not like he's off finding some phony little side issue. What'll be interesting, though, is what the solution is. If Republicans and Democrats can roughly agree that inequality is a problem, the question is, how do you fix it? And one interesting figure is in the course of health care and the fight over affordable health care, now Gallup says that 56% of the country doesn't believe everybody should have insurance. That used to be a majority opinion. So the question is, if everybody thinks inequality is a problem, how does, once we get through this big fight, who wins the argument of what the solution is, and does that warp and change the way people think about inequality? Because people do feel like things have gotten out of whack. The question is, the president will be framing it one way, Republicans will be saying, well, this is about jobs.
The funny thing about inequality is it's as if everybody has just discovered this problem of the rich are really rich and the poor are really poor and the middle is gaining.
The argument, though, is that they're getting more so. The rich are getting a lot richer.
And normally this administration used to brag about how well the stock market was going. And in a way, it's almost the negative side of one argument. But the answer so far to inequality is being presented now, even in New York, brand new mayor, progressive, lefty, former Sandinista. What he's saying essentially is the old answer.
Former Sandinista? No, I didn't know that.
Sorry, former. I beg your pardon. That is not true. Former enthusiast for Sandinista-like political movement in Nicaragua. But what he's saying essentially is the old playbook, not the new playbook. The old playbook is inequality, I will raise your taxes, and I will raise spending. Well, there's nothing revolutionary about that. That's the old playbook.
I think that's why the Obama people are so nervous and are saying, on unemployment and minimum wage, it has economic growth benefits. You hear them talk a lot about the number of jobs and the GDP effects. That's all about saying this is about growth, business, and shrinking the deficit. It's not about redistribution and those old arguments.
Let's take a little break here, and we'll come back and talk. I want to talk about the United States overseas and what's going on there. Well, we're back now with our panel, and I want to talk to David Sanger a little bit about this. I thought one of the saddest pieces of news last week was what's happening in Iraq now. We're in Fallujah. This is a place, Anbar province, where one-third of the Americans who were killed in the Iraq War lost their lives in that province. It now looks like it's in the hands of anti-government forces. If not, will soon be. What's happened there?
It is. What's happened here is that as America left Iraq and as it's leaving Afghanistan, and as many perceive the U.S. to be pulling back some from the Middle East, something I think a contention that John Kerry would argue with as he's there now, you have seen a power vacuum develop. And power vacuums get filled in that region by extremist groups. And in this case, the extremist group is the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, which is basically an al-Qaeda Sunni affiliate that wants to not only take back Ramadi and Fallujah, but erase the border between Iraq and Syria, make the Syrian conflict into a transnational one. The big question is, what could President Obama have done differently? change. So we went into Iraq with the concept that we would somehow change the state, and I think we've all concluded that there was a fair bit of hubris to that. But when President Obama came out, his view was that a light footprint strategy could keep fighting back against al-Qaeda and its affiliates. And I think what we're seeing now, Bob, is that the light footprint, which was basically the use of special forces, of drones, of cyber, these weapons that don't involve Americans to go in on the ground very much or stay very long, that's running out of gas.
Well, David, what happens now? What can we do? What should we do?
Well, some group of people is going to have to take on al-Qaeda in the Euphrates Valley, in Syria and Iraq both. And the danger is that we've had a coalescence of al-Qaeda forces. That's being done now by the Maliki government, the Shiite-led, Iranian-backed Maliki government in Baghdad. In Syria, it's being done to the extent it's being done at all by the government of President Bashar al-Assad and elements of the opposition we've been trying to back. I mean, while I understand David's point about the big Spenglerian themes of American decline, as I look at this story, I see little mistakes. It wasn't inevitable or essential that people would stop paying the Sons of Iraq, the tribal fighters in Fallujah, which was just overwhelmed this week, in Ramadi, in these cities, to stand up against al-Qaeda. That was happened because Maliki let it happen, and we basically acquiesced. Same thing in Syria. Secretary Clinton, General Petraeus, Secretary Panetta, all of our top national security officials said in mid-2012, we've got to get started backing rebels who can suppress al-Qaeda. We're going to have a huge problem. The president decided not to do it. It wasn't a huge mistake. It was a small mistake. But today, that's what we're living with. And there's going to be a new war against al-Qaeda in that part of the world. That's coming.
Well, I mean, will the United States go back to Iraq?
Not in the, as David said, not in the large footprint way. But, you know, we are already providing. Iraq's the only country in the world asking for NSA surveillance technology. We are providing every kind of you know, a tool we can give them to help them go after al-Qaeda, find out who they are and go after them.
Will that be enough, David?
That's the big question, because every time that President Obama has chosen this method of trying a small arms shipments, whether it's in Syria or whether it's in Iraq, it's proven not to be up to the job. And the problem that he faces right now is that in President Maliki in Iraq, he has allied himself or has found himself stuck with somebody who has not been willing to make any kind of compromise or concession. And so that's opened up this Sunni-Shia divide. In Afghanistan, we haven't done a whole lot better with President Karzai. And I think the big question is, if you don't have leaders on the ground who you can trust to take this on and do it in a smart way, what do you do short of reengaging? And I'm in complete agreement with David. There is no way that President Obama is going to send back American forces on the ground into places that he staked his presidency on coming out of.
And that's particularly true of a year where one of the bright spots he hopes for him is being able to celebrate the return of troops from Afghanistan. Even though some are staying, 7,000 to 10,000, he's going to champion the fact that 40-some thousand are coming back and that's a promise fulfilled from his original campaign.
Well, do we in fact know? I mean, is the Afghan government going to sign off on the agreements that will allow us to keep 7,000 there? Because I can't imagine we're going to keep American troops there if they are subject to being arrested and prosecuted by Afghan forces if the Afghans somehow say they've committed some sort of crime. And that's one of the issues here. We'll not put our troops in that position. Would we, Dave?
We would not, and my guess is that this will be finessed. I think that the position the U.S. is taking is the agreement is signed, Karzai is going to go along with it, and he will get pushed from every political direction. Afghans do not want to, for the most part, do not want to see the U.S. Leaving. They know what's ahead, which is another civil war.
Peggy?
It all feels sad and repetitive, and I think once again we will go back to debating the question, what is in America's strategic interest in this part of the world as it struggles through the mess it is in? Second question, as I keep wondering, is this going to, what's going on in Iraq and Syria, spill over into Lebanon, which would be
I'm very afraid
tragic. It already has.
Well,
sadly.
I mean, in a big way. Yeah. That would be really something.
David, let me just, if I could shift quickly, because I meant to ask you this earlier and I forgot. The New York Times, really, your newspaper, saying you're responsible for everything in that. That's why we have you here today. Your newspaper said that Edward Snowden should somehow be given some sort of amnesty, and they called him a whistleblower, not a traitor. What's going on here?
This was in an editorial in the Times, yes. And as you point out, I'm on the news side, not the editorial side.
But
I thought the editorial was interesting because both the Times and the Guardian in Britain came out to basically the same position, which was that the United States should either offer an amnesty or some kind of deal to get Snowden back. What I found particularly interesting is that it was echoing something that had been said on 60 Minutes by the man at the NSA who's been trying to track down what it was that Snowden left with. And he was raising the possibility, which his boss immediately shot down, that Snowden might be offered a deal so that you could recover what it is that he has stolen. I'm not sure at this point it's recoverable because we don't know where all the copies of it are. What I find interesting is that inside the White House, there is absolutely no appetite for this at all. Their view is Snowden broke a law, broke his own agreements, and there will be no deal.
Do you think, John, that the president will, though, call for the National Security Agency to be reined in some way?
He will. He will. It was interesting in his press conference at the end of the year that he said, the balance has been struck, and I'm confident, and there's been no abuses, but... And then he said, because of the Snowden releases and people's worries about this, reforms need to be put in place. And so two that are being considered is one, having all of this metadata, the phone numbers, the tracking, be held by a third party, not by the government. And the other is having some kind of an advocate. So if all of the information is in a box somewhere with a key, that you have a tougher process for getting the key to get into the box. And that those are some safeguards to make sure this isn't abused. But the president's not going to admit that it's abused. What will be interesting in his speech is whether he tries to make a larger strategic argument about where we are more than 10 years after 9/11.
All right. Well, I want to thank all of you. We'll be back with a look back at one of the most notorious guests ever to appear in the 60 years of Face the Nation. Of all the guests who have appeared on Face the Nation over the past 60 years, none got here under more bizarre circumstances than Fidel Castro, who appeared on this broadcast 55 years ago on January 11th, 1959. Just weeks after he and a group of young revolutionaries overthrew Cuba's dictator. That is our Face the Nation flashback. When a CBS News crew got word that Castro agreed to the interview, they flew to Havana, only to learn they had been scooped by, of all people, CBS Entertainment star Ed Sullivan, who had flown in ahead of them and interviewed Castro in a jungle town. Sullivan felt, and I'm not making this up, that if he got a big interview, CBS News chief Ed Murrah would be impressed and invite him to be on the end-of-the-year correspondence roundtable. When Castro finally showed up for the Face the Nation interview, it was a wild scene. 200 armed men came with him, two of whom kept carbines pointed at producer Ted Ayers throughout the broadcast.
Fidel Castro, Face the Nation.
Once the interview got underway, Castro made a series of declarations and promises, none of which ever came true.
As a lawyer and as one who has spoken very eloquently about the civil rights that must be guaranteed to the Cuban people, how do you explain?
I will never be against any right that is my thinking in politics.
Very good.
I am not communist at all, but I will never be against any right.
Will all political parties be allowed to run candidates in these elections?
Yes, of course.
All political parties, including the directorial.
Of course, if we don't give free to all the political parties to organize, we are not a democratic country. We have fought for the democracy here, and we believe in democracy.
As interviews go, that one stands alone in that almost nothing Castro said proved correct. And one footnote. Since Face the Nation aired before Ed Sullivan's Sunday night primetime show, the Face the Nation interview was the first on American television. And, as you might guess, a furious Edward R. Murrow never invited Sullivan to be on any CBS News program. Well, that's it for today. Before we go, a little shout-out to our graphic artist, Deborah Hasselmark, who's been designing and redesigning our special 60 Years of Face the Nation graphics for months now. We want to say thank you, Deb. And be sure to tune in tomorrow for the latest on this freezing winter weather on CBS This Morning with Nora O'Donnell, Charlie Rose, and Gail King. As for Face the Nation, we'll be back here next Sunday, and we'll see you then.
This has been Face the Nation with CBS News Chief Washington Correspondent Bob Schieffer. Today's guests were Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid and Congressmen Peter King and Matt Salmon. The executive producer of Face the Nation is Mary Hager. The senior producer is Rob Hendon, and the producer is Emily Bradley. This broadcast was directed by Sue Ann Stocky-Wayne. Face the Nation originates from CBS News in Washington. For more Face the Nation, we're online at facethenation.com. And you can follow Face the Nation, Bob Schieffer, and CBS Radio News on Twitter, Google+, and Facebook.